When we think of Valentine's Day, obviously we think about hearts, and we're thinking more about hearts as they relate to love, but we also think about hearts as they relate to our blood and physiology. And of course, I think about it this way because I'm a doctor, so I've invited one of my fellow doctors, Dr. Lowell Gerber, a cardiologist who practices in Freeport, to come in and talk to us about this wonderful organ that helps us pump blood throughout our bodies and really keeps us alive. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for such a nice introduction. Because I too feel that the heart is the source of love and relationship in life. However, what we were just talking about earlier in medical school and the medical profession, I sometimes have arguments with my colleagues that to say that the heart only exists to hold the two lungs together, or the heart only exists to provide a source of blood supply to the brain, or the heart only exists to circulate blood to the gastrointestinal tract or the ovaries or uterus or whatever their organ of interest is. And so I'm very pleased to be part of a discussion where we can talk more about the holistic effects of the heart and what it represents.
You and I spoke on the phone yesterday, and it was interesting to me because you were an interventional cardiologist for
30 years.
And I think you described an early sense that really the body was just a box around the heart. When you were, this is the heart, this is your focus, you're going to go in there, you're going to do what you need to the heart, and the body just becomes this box.
Well, and actually, it's when I step back and have this out-of-body experience and look back on what I was doing, so actually the body was lying on a table. And I had my means and mechanisms for getting into the body, but the heart actually was located in a box suspended over the body. So in your cath lab, for many of the newer physicians, I think it's unfortunate, but they take this as a video game. So truly for 30 years, I was focused on a very small portion. In fact, when I was putting in a stent in a coronary artery, I was interested in about a segment of the artery that was maybe 1 to 2 centimeters long and maybe 3 millimeters in diameter. And beyond that, it was somebody else's territory. Now, I had an interest in cardiac rehabilitation, and I have a master's degree in exercise physiology, and I never gave that up. But as I went into medical school, I became like all the other doctors and basically put aside everything that I'd been learned in the science of anatomy, physiology, pathology, biochemistry, and began to follow the guideline-based medicine that we're all now accustomed to.
Well, I want to step back and explain for people who have never been in a cardiac cath lab, and maybe people who have been but don't really realize what you're saying, that when you're, and I was part of this when I was a medical resident, a medical student, you go in there, the person's on the table, there's stuff that's happening to the person, but what you're looking up at is basically a screen, a television screen. So it really does feel like you're kind of monkeying your fingers around in a very highly skilled way to get an achieved result up on a screen.
Exactly.
That must have been a very kind of, well, let's just say disembodied experience.
Well, and that's why I call it reflecting back on my 30 years in the cath lab as an out-of-body experience, because we got very accustomed to knowing a patient by the disease that they had, and our exposure to the patient very often, many of the physicians that I know really didn't examine a patient very much. The interventionalist, when they met the patient, there was a small opening in the gown over the groin area and now over the wrist. And for many of them, that was really the introduction. We try to avoid that now and get to know our patients better, but still, it is a very impersonal way of taking care of patients. This is the surgical approach. There are many people who have bonded with their surgeons or with their obstetricians. I don't know as many that have bonded with their interventional cardiologists, because typically the relationship is quite short. What used to be an experience where somebody would have a heart attack and come in, they'd be in the hospital for 2 weeks. So now they come into the emergency room. They're met with a very skilled team who makes their assessments very quickly. There's a stopwatch that starts ticking. There's a time frame to get them into the cardiac catheterization laboratory to get the procedure completed. And it used to be called the door to balloon time, and now it's the call to balloon time. So from the time the patient calls for help, the stopwatch starts.
And the balloon is?
The balloon is the device that's put into the artery to deploy, usually to deploy a little piece of metal that's called a stent. So when the artery is blocked, we open it with a balloon and then put a stent in there to keep it open. So that's all on the clock right now. And now there are case managers who are meeting with the family when the patients come into the emergency room with their heart attack to begin the discharge planning. So a patient may come in with a heart attack and be out of the hospital within 24 hours. So the whole time that we had to bond with the patient, develop a physician-patient relationship, to take advantage of that teachable moment when the patient and their family are suffering a medical crisis and they're more open to listen to things, that's really been diminished. And so for many patients, they're in and out so quickly, for many of them, it quite literally is difficult for them to believe that anything bad really happened. Because it goes so quick, they're sedated, they're treated very humanely. But the teachable moment is gone. And so one of my interests is to make lifestyle changes for people. And usually that teachable moment is when a patient and their family are very much open to a lifestyle change. But that's gone for many.
Well, after 30 years being an interventional cardiologist, and for people who are listening, an interventional cardiologist, just define that a little bit.
So there are different types of cardiologists. So back when I started training, there was no such thing as an interventional cardiologist. There were clinical cardiologists who were physicians that often worked in their office. And there were invasive cardiologists who often did most of their work or some of their work in the hospital doing those procedures where you actually do something to the patient to make a diagnosis. And that something was usually putting a small tube into an artery, a peripheral artery, usually in the groin, and then advancing a tube up into the arteries of the heart and taking a picture of the heart and often putting a tube into the chambers of the heart and measuring the pressures, and that was called catheterization. So the invasive cardiologist did cardiac catheterization, measuring the pressures of the structure and function of the heart, and coronary angiography. So it was cardiac catheterization and coronary angiography. And then in the late 70s and early 80s, for the first time, we were able to actually do something to the artery besides take a picture of it or measure its function. And the first things that were done were using a balloon to stretch the artery open. And at the same time, we learned how to stretch the arteries in the legs open, the arteries in the kidneys, the arteries actually leading to the brain were done very early. But the problem was they kept coming back. And so then in the mid-80s and early 90s, we introduced putting little pieces of metal around that balloon called a stent. And that's probably one of the most frequent procedures done in the United States today is opening an artery. So the cardiac catheterization, measuring the pressures and function, and the coronary angiography taking the pictures are a preliminary step. And then the next step is actually to do something to the patient to change them. And that's putting the balloon and stent in. Now that's gone well beyond that now because now we put artificial valves in without surgery. We put stents in the carotid arteries to hopefully to prevent stroke, into the renal arteries to prevent kidney failure, in the arteries of the legs to relieve symptoms. So it has really expanded, and now we do this in not only in neonates to avoid recurrent congenital heart surgeries, but there are procedures done in utero. In the fetus, they can do
things. So you're talking neonates, babies.
We're talking about babies before they're born.
Babies before they're born.
Mm-hmm. So this whole idea of interventions in cardiology and radiology, I've got to give a lot of recognition and respect to the interventional radiologists who've helped this field develop. It's not just cardiology, not just radiology. It's been neurologists. It's been nephrologists. It's really been a blossoming of physicians who want to do something for their patients more proactive than surgery.
Well, this is a good place to for me to jump in, because what you've just spent this time describing, and I think it's really helpful because we hear these terms and people who are listening, they hear these terms, but we don't always get them defined as clearly as that. But it sounds very technical. I mean, it sounds like a very technical field where you have to be very skilled with your, you have to be intelligent, you have to be able to use your fingers in a way to manipulate the things that need to go into very small spaces. And it's what we've been able to offer patients is truly amazing. And we've been able to prolong lives. We've been able to do really wonderful things with the technology. But after 30 years of doing this technical stuff, you've really shifted the way that you now practice medicine. And you're in the process of shifting this. So,
correct. Well, one of my interests became what's called now multivascular disease. And that's why I tried to bring in all those other disciplines. Because the same disease process not only affects the coronary arteries, but affects arteries throughout the body. So we reach a point as people age and develop other medical problems that promote this atherosclerosis. Do we get to a point where we're going to put stents in two carotid arteries, two renal arteries, three coronary arteries, and arteries in the legs? Where does it end? And maybe we're approaching this a little too late. Now, my father was a dentist, and he got interested in dental prevention very early and was at odds with the Chicago Dental Society because prevention really wasn't something people were really interested in then. And so maybe some of that's rubbed off on me as I've maintained my interest in interventions, but also in cardiac rehab and prevention. And a lot of what we've heard about prevention has been pretty much held as blasphemy, that it doesn't work, it can't work, and that anybody who tries to reverse these things is a quack. And I believe that. And I had a fair number of patients who were getting chelation therapy in Florida, where I practiced for a long time, that had failed chelation therapy. The disease progressed despite it. And so, of course, we just said, this is just more proof that, you know, you can't change it. And what we do as interventional cardiologists, putting in a balloon and a stent, is the answer. And then, as we got better at putting in balloons and stents, the technology got better, the devices got safer. We, I'm speaking generically amongst interventional cardiologists and radiologists, started to feel, well, if most heart attacks occur with a plaque that's less than a 50% blockage, I don't think most people know that. Most people think that if you have a severe blockage, that's when you have a heart attack. Well, if it happens acutely, if a plaque ruptures and it blocks an artery, then people have a heart attack. But most of those heart attacks occur from plaques that are less than 50% obstruction of the lumen. In fact, most of them are 30%. And we call this now a vulnerable plaque because we know more about the pathophysiology. So many of my colleagues felt that, well, if stenting a 70 to 90% stenosis is a good thing, then maybe we should be stenting the 30 to 50% stenoses to prevent them from ever having a heart attack. And that was called plaque sealing, S-E-A-L-I-N-G, not C-E-I. We hear a lot now about ceilings, fiscal capital debt ceilings, but we're talking about a different type of sealing. And so physicians, thinking that they were doing a good thing for their patients by sealing these vulnerable plaques in vulnerable patients, we began to create a new disease category of stent thrombosis, stent dissections. So we always have to keep in mind that we want to do something for our patients and not to our patients. And there's a lot of drive to do things to people for a lot of different reasons.
Well, and you're right that this is, and again, it's very important. If you have a patient who comes in with a lesion, you certainly don't want them to have a heart attack or a stroke. So it's not that this doesn't have its place. But you've been working more upstream than that, literally and figuratively, I think.
Yep.
You've been working more with metabolic disease, with obesity, with dietary changes. And you've been trying to get people to a place where you're trying to impact things before they get to the place where they need to have a stent. So talk to me about that.
So this is where I start the conversation with my patients. And I started out my life doing exercise physiology. I have a master's degree, was working on a PhD in that. And in medical school, I was doing research on endothelium, injecting very minute amounts of what's called endotoxin. It's an inflammatory component of bacterial cell walls, and studying the interaction between the blood and the vessel wall. And I've been looking at that for 30 years. As I got into interventional cardiology, my life was taking care of the other end of that experimental model, and that is the effects of chronic disease on the endothelium, the plaque buildup. So I've been trying to put that together, but it's always been at a distance. It's been a research interest. It's been a clinical interest. And then what happens at age 50, I think I mentioned this to you, at age 50, I realized that I had been doing triathlons. I've been a cross-country team, been an athlete all my life. I was doing triathlons. And then at age 50, I started to slow down. I started to gain weight. Had done nothing different about my exercise regimen or my diet, but I was slowing down and gaining weight. And my running partner, who was 73 years old, was starting to pull ahead of me. And we would run one day, swim one day, cycle one day, do resistance training one day. Then often we would go and look at the course and do the course, because you had to be competitive, you really had to know the course. You had to know where to leave your bike, where to leave your shoes, where to leave your, pick up your goggles. And so we would do that one day and just do a light workout. Then we would compete and take a day off. And we did that almost every, in Florida, you could do a triathlon more than once a week if you really wanted to. And so my own doctor told me that I should give up the Mediterranean diet that I was on because there was too much fat in it. I should go on a very low-fat diet, get the fat out of my diet. And I should start doing what I told my patients. They should work out 3 to 5 days a week at 30 to 45 minutes of moderate intensity, because I was eating too much fat and I was overtraining. And so I did that. And I gained more weight. My cholesterol wasn't bad, but it never got where we wanted it, and he wanted to start me on statins. My blood pressure was nearly never really high at rest, but on the treadmill test, it went up a little bit too much, and so he wanted me to take an ACE inhibitor. Both my mom and dad had coronary artery disease, but both at very late age, but he wanted to be, you know, preventive and started me on aspirin. And so now I'm on aspirin, beta blocker, statin, an ACE inhibitor, and I'm following the advice I give my patients, and I'm gaining weight, my cholesterol is not getting to target, my blood sugar, my fasting blood sugar is still at it was normal, but it was the upper ranges in the 90s. And he's telling me that, you know, I realize, Dr. Gerber, that you're very, very busy, you make rounds, you do all these procedures, but you need to start taking care of yourself. You need to follow this diet and do this exercise. And then I just kind of got very flushed and had this, I call it an aha moment, where I said to myself, oh my God, he's accusing me of not doing, I'm doing exactly what I should be doing. In fact, I'm doing less than what I used to be doing, and I'm gaining weight, my blood pressure's going up, my blood sugar and my cholesterol is not a target. I said, oh my God, my patients weren't lying to me. I was so arrogant that I would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning with a patient having a heart attack, put a balloon in the stent, in the widowmaker, that's the proximal part of the artery where if it closes off completely, they die. We'd get him into the lab, open it up, I'd pat him on the back, saved your life, pat myself on the back, I saved his life. And I'd give him this regimen to follow and ask him to see me back in 6 weeks to 3 months. And if they weren't a target, if they hadn't made the goals I set for them, I would have them see my dietitian about a very low-fat diet. I'd have them go to the gym that I selected because they were a very medically oriented type of gym, and have them follow the American College of Sports Medicine guidelines that were recommended. And I'd have them come back, and they still hadn't made their progress. And again, I was so arrogant, I would say, you better, you know, really get with the guidelines here, because you're going to have another heart attack and nobody may be able to get to you quick enough to save your life. And they'd say, Doc, look at me. Here's my journal. I go to your dietitian. Here's my exercise log. I go to your gym. I breathe air. I drink water. I eat granola. And look at me. And then when I did it to myself, when I had gained 50 pounds, had metabolic syndrome with prediabetes, prehypertension. My cholesterol was a little bit too high. And then found I had a plaque in my carotid. I said, oh my God, I am doing it to myself following the guidelines. And that's when my life shifted 180 degrees. I said, you know what? Something's wrong here. And I had to find out what was wrong.
So what are you doing differently now? What do you now offer your patients and now practice yourself?
So what I had to do for myself is find out why wasn't I following those guidelines. They're supposed to work for everybody. And what I did is just had to go back in my memory to where was I when I was working on my PhD in exercise physiology, when I was studying body composition and nutrition. And so I went back and looked at what we knew 40, 50 years ago and looked at where we are now. And then looked for a type of physician that had a more of a holistic approach to treating a human body than the guidelines. In other words, you know, what is it about Lowell Gerber that his diet isn't the same for him as other people, the exercise, or what are the metabolic hormonal factors are there? And so I found a physician that would do that, that would have a very personalized approach to find out from detailed history, physical, family history, biochemistry, hormonal patterns, you know, where am I today? And as most of us in medicine have had to learn, some of us the hard way, is that patients have wants and needs, and I knew where I wanted to go, but he knew where I needed to go, and they weren't the same, because he was thinking about individualized, personalized care, and I wanted to follow the guidelines, because that's what I had been taught. And so it took me a little bit while to wipe my slate clean and follow what they had told me to do, and that as a former researcher, physician, PhD candidate, to go back and look at it for myself and make up my own mind. And they gave me several choices that I could follow. And I looked at the information that they led me to. They didn't spoon feed me, but they led me to information. And it led me to believe that not everybody is the same. And the recommendations that they were actually making for me made a lot of sense when I looked at what the science of human physiology, anatomy, biochemistry, metabolism, nutrition tells us. So I made a big deviation from what I was doing for myself and recommending for my patients. And in that process, at first I was worried about the metabolic issues, the carotid plaque, the prediabetes, the prehypertension, the hyperlipidemia. And in the process of that, I started to lose weight. I said, this is pretty neat. You know, I'm not really doing a weight loss program here, but I'm losing a lot of weight just because of what I'm doing. And I got interested in that aspect of it from talking to other physicians. I went to get trained in some of these things and talking to other physicians. I spoke to a physician, for example, who had a PhD in reproductive endocrinology and took care of celebrities who need to lose weight or gain weight. And what he told me was just, I had never heard of this before. And so it just ignited my natural curiosity, I guess, having started out actually as an engineer before I went to physiology and trying to figure out how things work. And so now, over the last 4 years, I've just become a perpetual student, trying to find out what helps me and what helps my patients. And a lot of what I've done, I've gone around the country as a professional patient and gone through their clinics, gone through their programs to find out what it's like. And if it works on me, great. If it doesn't work on me, well, it doesn't mean it doesn't work on a woman, but at least I know what the process is to go through to do these things. Now, I haven't accepted to have a lap band or gastric bypass surgery, but I've tried almost all the different diets and a lot of the different medications out there. Just what's it like? What's it like to do this? What do you get out of it?
And now you come back to your own practice and patients come to see you and you try to offer them an individual approach based on all of this information you've gleaned from different sources.
Yep. So what we just talked about, I've talked about individualizing the nutrition based on what their particular metabolic and hormonal status is, their age, their gender. We talk about the type of exercise that's best for them. It's very interesting, at the same time the obesity epidemic took off in the late 70s, mid 80s, jogging became very popular. It wasn't that popular before then. I was on the cross-country team, in high school in the 60s, and people looked at me like a weirdo because I ran long distances. Nobody else was doing that. And at the same time, people got interested in vegetarianism. So exercise doesn't have to be the same thing for everybody. We have all kinds of different types of exercise which may benefit some people more, some genders more, some disease states more. So when I see people go to a gym, if they have diabetes, chronic fatigue syndrome, Lyme disease, Parkinson's, very often they get the same prescription. Nobody understands the difference. Then there's all these nutritional supplements, antioxidants, and vitamins. It's a huge business. And so what I try to do is target for that individual patient. Where are they going to get the most for their money? They can't afford to buy all these different products. And for a lot of the patients, I tell them, if you're somebody, I'd like to get people into routine, a lifestyle change, but if I'm trying to get them to lose 50 pounds in an aggressive program, what I'll tell them is, look, you're going to be on a nutritional regimen, but it's going to change because your metabolism is going to change, your hormones are going to change, your micronutrient demand is going to change. So for a period of time, understand that we're going to be changing this until we get to a maintenance program. Same thing occurs with hormone status. I mean, the most frequent hormone that I optimize is insulin. But then there's thyroid, there's ovarian hormones, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, DHEAS. A lot of people have never heard of those. In fact, they're told to stay away from them because they're dangerous. So those are the things that I incorporate. And then as a physician, I don't mind starting people on medications, but quite frankly, I spend more time taking them off of medications that aren't needed.
You and I could spend hours and hours on so many different aspects of this because I know that this is something you've dedicated your entire life to. It's so hard to encapsulate this down into an hour-long show. How can people find out more about the work that you're doing in the community? And where can they hear you speak and connect with you personally? What's the best way to reach you?
Okay. Well, at this moment, I'm actually in a metamorphosis professionally. I've done cardiology now for 30 years, finished my cardiology training. I hate to see this, in 1980. And transitioning more to a full-time practice of a combination of preventive aging, preventive cardiology, and weight management. And I've been actually questioned by some of my patients about why would a physician who's interested in preventive aging include children and families? I'm developing a medical retreat for my fantasy would be to have baby boomers with their parents and their kids. Because when I see a middle-aged woman who comes in who wants to lose weight and she's got kids at home and her own parents to care for and she's working because of the economy, she doesn't have time to fix six different meals. So part of the challenge is to figure out the dynamics of the family as well as the dynamic. So it has to be a lifestyle that they'll stick with. So it may not be perfect, but it's better than what they're doing. So I see children who are, and you probably see them as well, they're infants. Most recently I took care of a 9-year-old who had obesity, hypertension, prediabetes, and hyperlipidemia. And the answer by his pediatrician was to make him work out more, and put them on antihypertensives, glucose-lowering, and statin drugs.
But when people come to see you, you don't do that for them. And I know your practice is in transition, but how do people contact you?
So I have a webpage, and you can go to www.leanerme, leanerme.com, or the new complete practice. So LeanerMe is the weight management aspect. I have an age management practice, which was live younger, love longer, be strong. And those two are being combined into a single program called Younger, Leaner Me. And so all those will lead to me. I didn't bring a business card today because I've got consultants, my goodness, telling me, how to design the card, how many letters to have, and that's the part of this I don't like, but in order to get the word out as you're doing for me now, people need to know how to get a hold of me. So www.leanerme.com is probably the easiest. And I hope to have the new practice up and running full probably by Valentine's Day. That's kind of my target right now.
Perfect. Well, as I said, there's just so, you're just a wealth of information, and I know that there are many, many more shows that we could do on various aspects of what you're doing, and I congratulate you for spending all this time and really trying to understand things so that you can create personalized plans for people, preventive cardiology plans, and other weight loss plans. So I appreciate your coming in and speaking with us today. We've been talking with Dr. Lowell Gerber, whose cardiology practice is in Freeport.
Thank you so much for helping me get the message out, for particularly for women on Valentine's Day. And I will be giving this talk on preventive cardiology in Freeport and Portland, and it'll be in the newspaper and on my website.